So let's go back to a case and we'll kind of see how this plays out in real life, so to speak. Beth, how about this 68-year-old lady?
Yeah, this is another patient of mine. Again, found on a screening CT, her right upper lobe mass. Now, she had mediastinal node there. You can see a 4R and an 11R. It was diagnosed as adenocarcinoma on a bronch EBUS. She has a history of anxiety and some stents for some vascular disease. So she underwent concurrent chemoradiation. And she tolerated very well, a little bit of esophagitis, not bad. I put in here post-chemo rad scan, no disease progression. And I do want to make that clear. A lot of insurance companies are now requiring that we get a scan prior to approval of durvalumab to prove that there is no disease progression post-chemo rads. And while we're kind of saying, you know, most patients don't, it is possible. You can have disease progression, and it's a very poor prognostic sign because, let's be honest, chemo rads is the best we got. So if your cancer worsens through that, that's a poor prognostic sign. The majority of patients don't, but we do have to prove that usually prior to starting immunotherapy with durvalumab.
Before you go on, I wasn't aware of that, and I thought it was very interesting and kind of curious. Liz, same thing. You do this, you know, it seems like the likelihood is extremely low that somebody would have progression after chemo radiation. Do you put the patient through a scan?
We do. We like to know the response, but I have to tell you, in my experience, we had one gentleman who, after concurrent therapy, had disease recurrence and metastasis on the first scan after treatment, and this is before any consolidation, certainly before immunotherapy. So Beth is right. It has happened, and he's the one candidate, the one patient I can remember that this happened to.
So anyhow, let's go back to the case, Beth. So she has her scan. There's no progression. Then what?
Yep. So she started on maintenance durvalumab in March of this year. On April 10th, she presented with shortness of breath that was progressively worsening. She didn't call us on April 10th. She called us a little bit later. And by April 21st, she presented to my office, and we did a CAT scan of her chest that did show pneumonitis. We attributed that to radiation due to timing, but it's always, you know, could the immunotherapy have contributed? So we did opt to hold the durvalumab while we treated her with prednisone on a tapering schedule. We also COVID tested her, of course, because shortness of breath, you know, this was right in the heart of it in April. So she tested negative, of course. And then her, if we go onto the scans, we can see she is still coughing. But if you look, that March 26 scan, you can see it a little bit there. It really wasn't called, but you can see it starting in that right upper lobe. And this was prior to durvalumab. Now, there is the April 21st scan on the right. You can see significant inflammation in her right lung. Again,
it looks like the left side looks good.
Left side looks great. And of course, that was the side that was spared from radiation. So this is likely radiation because you would suspect that pneumonitis from immunotherapy would be systemic and bilateral, but not always. So this can be a gray area. And then this, so the left is still that April 21st scan. And then you can see the May 15th is after completing a month of, or 4 weeks of steroids. And you can see it is starting to break up, but still kind of significant radiation damage there. And she is still coughing a lot. Dry, nagging cough, very typical of that radiation pneumonitis / fibrosis that patients can end up dealing with over time. And that's a picture of her at the Jersey Shore with her husband.
Any comments about taking care of her as a patient? Anything that was sort of different about her than other people in the same situation, Beth?
Yeah, I mean, she is very compliant. She will do exactly what I say. She's also very scared. I actually saw her yesterday, and she made me describe again, why didn't you do surgery on me? And then we went to the chart and we looked where level 4 nodes are. But, you know, she wants the best treatment. She will do whatever. She's the one I said will stand on her head for 60 minutes if I told her to, if it would help her, you know, beat this disease. She was very worried waiting that month off of durvalumab.
So, Stephen, I noted that this woman was tested for COVID and was tested negative. What's your approach in general to testing patients? I've seen recommendations that when you start therapy in lung systemic therapy in lung cancer, you should test patients? I mean, I guess it depends on where you are located, Stephen, but how do you approach the issue of testing in people who are asymptomatic and then patients who have pulmonary problems?
You know, it's evolving and it's changing a lot. I think it does depend on your geography and sort of what the incidence is right now. If you were in New York at the peak versus somewhere where very few cases were identified. So it varies a lot. Also varies by your testing capabilities and what your output can be. Right now, we're doing testing for anyone doing a procedure. So if someone's doing an aerosolizing procedure, such as a bronchoscopy, they'll get tested first. Any biopsies get tested. Anyone we're admitting to our bone marrow unit, for example, gets tested. But for chemotherapy, we're not testing right now. It's something we're talking about. We're testing at the sign of any symptoms. And as most institutions, you know, if anyone has a fever, they're really not permitted to come into our unit. We're checking temperatures. Everyone's wearing a mask and gloves, trying to minimize risk as much as we can. But this is not elective treatment. You know, we've got to move forward with it.
Ben, any comments on this issue? You know, just in general, the issue of pneumonitis or pulmonary problems in the lung cancer patient who's on immunotherapy can spark a lot of discussion. But I'm just kind of curious, Ben, right now, how COVID is fitting in. We know we did a program a couple of weeks ago on CLL and COVID, and there were a number of cases presented that sounded like the patient had COVID. They had fever, they had cough, they were exposed, but they tested negative. Yep. Ben, how's this playing out in terms of testing and integrating the diagnosis of COVID into patients who have pulmonary problems with lung cancer?
Well, it's in the differential, and there's probably no more of a complicated scenario than a virus that causes pulmonary complications in a patient already with pre-existing lung cancer who, oh, by the way, has received concurrent chemoradiation, and oh, by the way, has received durvalumab that can elicit potential pneumonitis. So, you know, we have a very low threshold to test patients for COVID, even if they have other reasons to have pulmonary complaints, patients who are undergoing concurrent chemoradiation that then go on to durvalumab. We have a very low threshold. We need to remember that, you know, unfortunately, there is a false negative rate with the COVID testing. The nasal swab, based on the data, anywhere from 20 to 30% may be negative, and still the patient may have COVID. We have also, in our institution, integrated the utility of an antibody test. We don't use it a lot. And it's not prime time for all patients. I just think we have to be careful and thoughtful. And you know, I think, again, once again, this is where medicine becomes an art and not a science. It's a discussion with the patient. We do have data, and you know, we are learning more about the collective experience both in Italy and China and now in the U.S. But, you know, yes, a lot of our lung cancer patients are tested for COVID when they have symptoms. And we also have to tell them that even if it's a negative, there's still a chance you may have it. And it's a very complicated, nuanced discussion that you have to have with patients.
And it always has been difficult to evaluate patients who have pulmonary problems on checkpoint inhibitors with lung cancer. They may have COPD, they have coronary artery disease, their therapy can be causing it, more cancer can be causing it. Now we're talking about an infection as well. But Beth, we also know there's a whole spectrum of toxicity that's seen with immunotherapy. I think it was if it ends in itis, you can see it. Can you talk a little bit about, in general, what you talk to patients about, Beth, who are about to begin a checkpoint inhibitor, including with durvalumab, and what some of the common problems are that you encounter?
Yeah, I'll be honest. When I'm talking to a patient starting immunotherapy, I'm going to be a little bit more vague about toxicities, because if I start saying hyperthyroidism and myocarditis, they're going to be like, what are you talking about? You know, I'm going to tell them that this drug is different from chemotherapy. It can inflame your body or increase your immune system overall. And therefore, if anything at all is wrong, please just give me a call and let us figure out if it's related to immunotherapy or not. You know, there's even been some calls to me that I had to really think, is that immunotherapy related or not? So there's no way a patient can make that decision on their own at home. So I stress to them, please just call us if you think anything is wrong, and then we will tease out whether or not we think that's from immunotherapy or not.
So, Stephen, the slide from you went through a review of toxicity of checkpoint inhibitors in your talk. Really fantastic review. This is one of the slides I really liked a lot, talking about some of the problems that you see with immunotherapy, but also related to when you see them. Can you comment on that, Stephen?
Yeah. So, The time frame I give is from day one to forever, because they can occur at any point, even long after stopping, which is why it's important we educate our primary care colleagues, our emergency room colleagues, that they can manifest things like adrenal crises and adrenal insufficiency potentially years later. But for the most part, and these are data from Pacific, we see some ranges. Most occur within the first few months. For example, pneumonitis, typically around 55 days is when we would see the onset of pneumonitis, which also happens to be around the time when you're at risk for radiation pneumonitis, maybe a little bit earlier for radiation. What they saw in Pacific was the next most common immune-mediated adverse events were thyroid, where just over 10% of patients had thyroid disorders. That usually occurred less than 3 months, between 2 and 3 months. And so we check pretty regularly. It usually lasts a few months. We're not sure if that's permanent damage at all. Radiation can sometimes lead to rash, but immune-mediated rash usually occurs a little bit earlier, tends to last longer, but primarily because it's usually low grade and we don't often have to do much about it. Diarrhea is less common. When it does occur, immune-mediated colitis, it's usually, again, around the two-month mark. So a new immune-mediated toxicity after 3 months, especially after 6 months, is uncommon, but it is possible.
So just kind of curious, Liz, I hear a lot about dermatologic problems with checkpoint inhibitors. Most of the time, it seems like it's not very difficult to manage, but from what I hear, it seems like it's pretty common. What do you see, Liz, in terms of skin problems with checkpoint inhibitors?
I have a few patients with some very mild erythematous patches on their chest or arms. We usually give them a topical steroid cream, and it really clears it up very quickly. It's not really painful or bothersome to the patient as much as they say, I've got a rash, and we take a look at it.
So also curious, Beth, about endocrine problems. We were talking about thyroid dysfunction, particularly hypothyroidism. What's your experience with that?
Yeah, I would say exactly what was seen there, somewhere between 10 and 15% of patients developing hypothyroidism. Make sure you get that baseline TSH. You'd be surprised how many patients are hypothyroid at baseline and didn't know it. So then you know you didn't cause it, at least by the immunotherapy, and you can get them on the proper treatment. I think the other thing to remember about the endocrinopathies is that unlike the other itises, you will not regain organ function for these endocrine systems. So for example, if you become hypothyroid from the immune checkpoint inhibitor and you're treated with synthetic hormone like levothyroxine, you will be on it for the rest of your life. You're not going to stop the immunotherapy and regain your thyroid function. That would be really uncommon.
So I'm kind of curious, do you see clinical manifestations of thyroid disease, Beth, hypothyroidism, gaining weight, change in voice, et cetera, because you're so on top of it, you're picking it up before they have some.
Yeah, I mean, hypothyroidism, it would be really uncommon for me to see any clinical manifestations. We're usually catching it, and typically it's not a fast rise. It's usually a subtle increase in their TSH. Once it gets around 10, we'll usually start managing it. But I will say my cases of hyperthyroidism that I've seen, those patients have been symptomatic. And we've had to deal with treating some of the side effects of that.
Yeah, because I think the thinking is maybe these patients are hyperthyroid initially, then become hypothyroid. So you see them clinically hyperthyroid, Beth?
Much less common. So only 1% or 2% become hyperthyroid before reverting to hypothyroidism. But for those patients, tachycardia is an issue often, weight loss, increased appetite, those types of things, hair loss, hair thinning. But we've used beta blockers, even dabbled in methimazole, but usually I'll have the endocrinologist take it from there if we need to do that to manage their symptoms. And like I said, we usually will educate them that probably you're just going to become hypothyroid. That thyroid gland is just going to stop the fight and let the T cells win. And then they'll revert to, levothyroxine treatment.
Ben, of course, we're focused a lot on the lungs because there's lung cancer, et cetera. But we also see issues in the GI tract, particularly the issue of colitis. So can you talk a little bit about that? Do you see that in lung cancer and how is it manifested?
It's certainly reported in the literature, and it is a possible side effect of these immune checkpoint inhibitors. It's usually manifested, obviously, by diarrhea and sometimes fevers and abdominal pain. And I think if you suspect this, you need to have a low threshold to treat it, and also partner with the gastroenterologist. I think as exciting as immunotherapy is, it has forced us as oncologists and nurses and nurse practitioners to be optimize our communication and really partner with these subspecialists so that we can work with them and also educate our ER and the hospitalist about these potential complications. So it's there, we see it. I haven't seen a lot of colitis. I can't accurately report the prevalence or incidence of it in the literature. It's probably less than 5%, at least in lung cancer trials, of significant colitis. But certainly something that needs to be managed with a partnership with the GI, a gastroenterologist, as well as early implementation of steroids, and obviously withdrawing the agent if it's a grade 3 or 4. But if patients have diarrhea, this is certainly on the differential for patients that are receiving immunotherapy.
So Beth, when Ben referred to hospitalists, I was flashing on the fact that I just did an audio program, a podcast with him. And the case that we presented to start it was a patient who was getting a checkpoint inhibitor for lung cancer who ended up in a small hospital ER, ended up being admitted for diarrhea, was in the hospital for a week in antibiotics and antifungals. Nobody thought about the fact that it was related. The patient was actually discharged, came back to clinic. The doc never even knew the patient had been in the hospital. Of course, they missed the fact that it was immunotherapy-related colitis, and Ben also is referring to the issue with ER docs. Any comment, Beth, on what you've seen in terms of awareness out there in the primary care community in hospitals about side effects of immunotherapy?
So that exact situation has happened to me twice that you just mentioned. And, you know, I sort of saw the patient back and the last guy that happened to came in and said, it's just not getting better. This diarrhea and mucus is not getting better. And I was even admitted and I looked back. I'm like, oh my gosh, of course you have colitis. It's not always the doctor's fault too. I had a patient who went in and just said, yeah, I'm on chemo. And so that ER doctor took the patient for her word, and she is alone. She has no caregivers with her. So no one vouched for the fact that she wasn't on chemo. She was on immunotherapy. And so she went in and they called us 2 days later saying, you know, that despite antidiarrheals and hydration, it's not getting better. And that's when we confirmed, no, she's on immunotherapy and, you know, you should be working her up for colitis and giving her steroids. I think the other important thing to really be careful with colitis is that oral steroids don't always work because their gut is so inflamed. So sometimes it requires IV steroids. I keep a really short leash on those colitis patients if I send them home on oral steroids.
We're getting a lot of comments in the chat room about this question. Someone said that they have their patients carry a card mm-hmm. that they're on immunotherapy. They try to educate ER nurses. Really interesting. We would love to do programs for them.